Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. With me in the studio today is my fellow host, Gus Cantavero.
Hi, everybody.
And doing double duty behind the board is In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And one announcement. We have been following the escalating war in the Mideast closely, and we will discuss it and analyze these developments next week on In Context Monthly War Report. That's the war report next Monday, November 26th at noon. And today's show, we're scheduled to speak with Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers. Oath Keepers is a nonpartisan organization of current and former military personnel, policemen, and others who are concerned about threats posed to our civil liberties by unconstitutional laws. And Mr. Rhodes is a constitutional lawyer and organized this group called Oath Keepers. We're trying to get him on the line. Do we have Mr. Rhodes on the line?
No.
No, we're unable to get him right now, so we may have to schedule him for a later date. But there's a lot going on in the war, particularly in Israel, in the love of the last few weeks. What's happened, just to bring you up to date, if you haven't been watching the following the news closely, is that there's been back and forth between Israel and the Palestinians just south of Israel on the Gaza Strip for some time now, rockets going back and forth. But it really escalated less than a week ago, about 6 days ago, when the Israel assassinated a top Hamas military commander in Gaza. And the Palestinians in Gaza then responded with a very sustained barrage of rockets. And it's just been going. And then Israel was responded with heavy air bombardments. So far, 85, as of this morning and in the news, 85 Palestinians have been killed and three Israelis have been killed. Hundreds of bombing sorties have been, or hundreds of targets in Gaza have been hit by the Israelis from aircraft and from bombs launched from sea. Targets in Gaza include the home of a Hamas commander, the prime minister's office, the police headquarters for the Palestinians in Gaza has been leveled. Gazans on the other hand, have been continuing the steady barrage of rockets, particularly into southern Israel, although a few of the rockets have managed to reach as far as Tel Aviv. So a big concern is about, is this going to continue to escalate? Are other players going to come involved, particularly what's going to happen with Hezbollah, which is in the north? And it's very important to understand that Hezbollah recently made an agreement with Hamas, the group that rules the Palestinians in Gaza, that Hezbollah will open a northern front against Israel if Israel launches a ground invasion of Gaza.
And I think it's actually very important to mention, too, I just brought this up in front of me just now. Debka, the Israeli intelligence newsletter, if any of our listeners are interested in visiting it themselves, by the way, I'm sorry, I have a bit of a cold. It's debka.com. They have an article now that says, Iranian arms ship carries fresh, improved Fajr missiles supplies for Gaza. So that's Iranian naval vessels are supposedly bound to deliver arms down to Gaza.
Yes.
This is Iran fulfilling its obligation per an agreement with Hamas. Hamas's leaders went to Tehran several months ago to sign an agreement, it wasn't in the words of mutual defense, but it was implied mutual defense. And so now Iran's fulfilling that obligation. So as you're talking about Hezbollah being treaty bound to enter the war on Hamas's side, Iran's fulfilling its obligation. Hezbollah, by logic, would fulfill its obligation as well.
So for the audience, it may not be clear on the geopolitics of the region. Iran, it's a dominant Shia power. Of course, the United States has been hostile to Iran for many years now, and Iran is often seen as the target of a U.S. and Israeli attack, presumably to stop its nuclear weapons. We've talked about how what's at stake here is control of really over half the oil in the world in the Persian Gulf. So we're talking about Iran and Iraq have a huge amounts of oil. And, of course, Saudi Arabia has a huge amount of oil and the Gulf states that are allied with the United States. So this small seemingly small war, which is going on between the Palestinians in Gaza, which is mm-hmm. a non-contiguous part of the Palestinian lands, off kind of in the, mm-hmm. if you're looking at the map, in the lower left-hand corner to the south of Israel. Borders Egypt and the Sinai. It's actually relating to a much bigger picture. And how are the nations, if we look at the nations in that region, Marshawn, how are they aligning up? You've got Iran. Who are Iran's regional allies?
Iran's regional allies would be the largely Shiite population, eastern Saudi Arabia, the population of Bahrain. Mind you, these governments are allied with the United States. However, their populations are pro-Iranian. Their regional governmental allies would be the Syrian government, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, and then to a much lesser extent, Egypt is not an ally, but neutrality is in of itself choosing a side.
And while we talk about religion as being really important to understanding the region, the Iranians, the leading Shiite power, their allies are not necessarily Shias.
No, not necessarily at all. In fact, their allies are more or less unified by their dislike of the United States and Israel. Now, that having been said, Iraq is not a natural Iranian ally, at least until after the United States invasion, when all of the Sunnis were expelled, then the Iraq became de facto an Iranian ally because the population was entirely Shia. And of course, they looked to Iran as their protector.
Strange how that works out, right? I mean, you think we're liberating the region to make allies, and then what instead we do is create more enemies.
The whole exactly. notion that we won in the war in Iraq is, I think, one of the fictions that has been foisted on the American people. In fact, in purging the Sunnis from the leadership in Iraq, we created an ally for Iran. And they are very, you know, to claim that we won the war is a real stretch. Just recently, the head of Iraq
Doesn't lose, Ken.
Yeah, right? It's like Vietnam. We didn't really lose Vietnam War.
We chose to lose.
So we've got the head of Iraq is up in Russia making an arms deal with the Russians. And, of course, you step back even bigger and you look at the broader picture than the region. Russia is clearly on the side. They're closely allied with Iran. And now they're having a stronger relationship with Iraq. They're very close. Russia is closely allied for many years with Syria. So
one of the things I think that's very important to note, if we want to understand Russia's influence, because that was one geopolitical ally I didn't hit on. Those are their regional allies, but their number one benefactor is Russia, and then to a secondary extent, China. But Russia, in particular, if you want to understand Russia's motivations for backing Iran, Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister of Russia, or President of Russia, I always get him confused because he and Medvedev switch off to it's futzing with the Russian Constitution, so it looks like a democracy, but that's beside the point. One of the things that I think is really interesting is in Putin's manifesto, he said he that controls the world's access to oil and natural gas controls the world. So this is all in keeping with the Russian imperial doctrine. The idea that if we sponsor Iran, if we support Iran, if we expel the United States from the Middle East, we, you know, expel the U.S. from Israel, we will control the world's access to oil. So they won't need to have an army in Paris or an army in Washington. They will control all our access to oil and natural gas. And so if we decide to become energy independent, we will end up then becoming only a regional power at best, because the rest of the world will still rely on oil and natural gas supplied by the Russians.
So what seems to be a localized conflict only involving Israel and its immediate neighbors has actually not just a big regional issue, but a global issue which could bring in Russia and the United States fighting each other. Now, why is Israel so important here, apart from the historic strong alliance between Israel and the United States? Israel has a strategic importance there, right? Sort of as a forward military base of the United States in this oil-rich region. Mm. And we, in fact, although it's not generally known, have troops there now, presumably on a training exercise. And we have also, of course, over the years, we've given Israel $3 billion a year in aid. So Israel is about as strong an ally as you can get. And we have been an integral part in their new missile defense program, which they call Iron Dome. Mm-hmm. We have...
which intercepts 30% of the incoming rockets.
they claim that they're doing better.
Smashing success.
It looks like it might be 30%. They claim they're doing better because they claim that it's only targeting rockets that they think are going to land in populated areas. Okay. So if you take out, so the percentage looks a lot better if you say, well, we weren't really chasing half of them. And I thought the New York Times actually had a very good...
So it's like defensive indifference.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, are U.S. personnel now directly involved? Are they manning some of the radar installations that are being used to track these incoming missiles from Gaza? One of the concerns that we've expressed on this show is the possibility that U.S. troops could be fighting in Israel, mm-hmm. in and around Israel, and what could be a disastrous war. And this is something that all Americans could be concerned about, especially since we have troops there now.
I think the irony is a lot of this parallels World War I very strongly. You know, when we think of World War I, we think of the Western Front, we think of the Battle of the Somme, you know, the British and the French duking it out with the Germans. But in reality, where World War I began in the Balkans with a conflagration between Austro-Hungary and Russia's proxy, Serbia. So what we're seeing happen is what happened before the outbreak of World War I was very analogous to what is happening now.
Yes.
What could potentially be a regional conflagration, because all of these superpowers are getting involved, has the massive potential to be a much larger war. And one thing that's, I think, very important to remember is newspapers in Britain and France, at the time of the Austro-Hungarian mobilization to invade Serbia, didn't even report it. It was reported in like the back page as a minor, you know, conflict in the Balkans. And this was what sparked off the First World War. The war to end all wars was a conflict that everybody else in the rest of the world thought meant nothing.
And one of the analogies which was brought to my attention by the historian William Engdahl is that the First World War was largely about the Baghdad to Berlin Railroad, which would have a deal that the German Empire made with the Ottoman Empire. It allowed them to build a railroad, all the way to the Mideast from Berlin, which would have given the Germans direct access to Mideastern oil. And remember, folks, oil was not important until around World War I, just before World War I, when the British Navy went from coal to oil, and then that became the absolute, the most important resource for your national security. So if the German Empire had direct access to oil overland route, it would have been a devastating blow to the power of the British Empire, which, of course, relied primarily on its navy to control its colonial empire. Well, so so World War I began in the Balkans because that was the missing piece of the Baghdad to Berlin Railroad, and the British had to stop that from being completed.
And in keeping with that, when we look at, you know, the control of the Middle East, Russia through Iran controlling, and China by extension, because let's not forget, China has a mutual defense treaty with the Russians, and China is selling arms and has military advisors in Iran as well. I mean, they're linked in really close, as China also does in Pakistan. To control Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and the Middle East gives whichever superpowers back Iran control over all of not just the oil and natural gas, but all of the pipelines. So if you want access to that oil, well, you have to go through a Russian Gazprom pipeline. You know, you can't, because the Iranians probably most likely don't have the ability to manufacture their own pipeline going from the Caucasus down through Georgia and the Middle East. But certainly Gazprom, the Russian state-owned oil company, does.
But Iran recently, and Engdahl again pointed this out in another article on the rising importance of natural gas, is that Iran and Iraq have signed a deal to build a pipeline which is going to go from Iran eventually to a port on the coast, I think in Lebanon. And the idea would be that would provide them an extra route for all of the new natural gas discoveries which are being found throughout the Mideast now, even off the coast of Israel in Qatar. And if this will give a huge boost to Iranian natural gas export, and particularly its ties to Europe.
Of course, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least if there are Chinese or Russian Gazprom engineers there assisting them.
Yes.
Because the Russians and the Chinese know that if Iran becomes a dominant figure in the Middle East, and Iran owes their victory to Russia and China, especially if they're horribly indebted to the Russians and the Chinese, then Iran would have to give Russia and China certain rights. Because Russia and China both have this history with their allies of, look, we don't care what kind of government you have. We don't care whether you take all the credit for this victory. All we care about, because we helped you, is getting access to certain rights or minerals or, you know, things like that, you know, pipelines. And so Iran will give that freely because here they are as the new Ottoman Empire, the new hegemonic
and superpower. And historically, we're the superpower in the region. For thousands of years, Iran has been the dominant power in the region. And, you know, you put your finger again on it, Marchand. As we've stressed over and over again the show, keep your eye on the ball. It's about control of natural resources, control of the pipelines for natural resources. And you're going to be fed from our government and from the corporate media a lot of distracting information about how we're fighting for democracy. That's not what it's about. It's about oil. It's about natural gas. It's about world power. And it's always been about that.
And, I mean, America right now has a lot of oil exploration going on right now. In Texas and the Dakotas, there's a huge oil boom here domestically and natural gas as well. I mean, there's so much natural gas out there that in a lot of the wells, they just burn it off because it's not even worth them piping it out. You know, the cost of natural gas has dropped so low.
I've read recently that we could be self-sufficient in
natural gas. We definitely could.
Gas.
There's also a lot of fields that are just being reserved, like Anwar in Alaska. You know, there's places where they're just not touching it when there's enough oil there to keep us running for decades. But the point is that they want to reserve the American oil for last resort, basically, so that if we ever cut ties with other parts of the world or we lose that public relations battle with the Middle East and China and Russia take over that area, we won't be dependent on them. We have tons of our own oil. The point is that we try to keep up the public relations with them so that they are dependent on our dollars, right? So that
that's it.
We want Saudi Arabia to be always on our goal.
Controlling the oil is not just about getting what we need. In fact, it's just as much about making sure that your rivals, Russia and China, and China in particular, do not get what they need.
That's what I think it's more about.
And that's the key factor, is that if we became energy independent, we would no longer be relevant as a world superpower, in so much as we would be a regional power, we'd be independent, we'd be self-sufficient, we wouldn't need anyone else, but then we couldn't lord it over the Europeans, we couldn't lord it over the Russians, we couldn't lord it over the Arabs by saying, well, if you want access to this oil, you're going to have to go through these companies, you're going to have to, you know.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM. Our scheduled guest, Stuart Rhodes, is unavailable. So we're speaking right now about the latest escalation in the war in and around Israel. And we'll be opening the phone lines in a few minutes. So we'll give out the number. In the meantime, if you want to drop us an email, you can send us a question or a comment to Ken at mdrtalk.org. That's Ken at mdrtalk.org. And we're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. And my name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Candavero, and our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
So I think one thing that's important to understand is the reason why the powers that be in the United States have such an interest in getting involved in these conflagrations is because, if we became energy independent, the Russians, the Chinese in particular, who have no natural resources, wouldn't need us anymore. The Europeans wouldn't need us anymore. So we would no longer be a superpower, be a regional power, be self-sufficient, be like Switzerland. But Switzerland doesn't dominate Europe. Switzerland's independent. Nobody screws with Switzerland. But they're not, globally, they're not an important power. They don't have an empire.
They're an economic power to be reckoned with, but they're not someone who forces their will on others for their own benefit, so to speak.
Exactly. Whereas we want to force our will upon, you know, whether it's the Europeans or the Arabs or the Russians and the Chinese in particular. We want to make sure the Russians and the Chinese can't enforce their will upon the people we wish to enforce our will on.
Marchand, if we get back to the events that are playing out right now, especially since Wednesday with the escalation of the violence there, a lot of people hear about rockets going towards Israel, but they may not understand what kind of rockets. And you understand the hardware. Could you talk about a Grad? What's a Grad rocket? What's a Fajr rocket? What can they do? Where do they come from?
Well, I'm actually glad you mentioned that. One of my favorite jokes, and I'm sure I'm probably dating myself a bit here. How many people have listened to Bob Newhart do his shtick on? Who was it?
Werner von Werner.
Yeah, it was supposed to be Werner von Braun, you know, and the rocket, you know. Well, that's an interesting experiment you do there with that firecracker and the tin can, you know. Well, I like the firecracker. It goes 3 or 4 feet up in the air, you know. And that's pretty much what a Grad rocket is. Mm-hmm. It's a firecracker and a tin can and with some explosive in the tip. And it's effective in so much as you can launch them in mass. It's not particularly accurate. It's smaller. It's short range. The Fajr rocket is a much larger rocket. Now, one of the things that I'm a little unclear on is the guidance system involved, because a rocket has no guidance system.
It's a rocket. A missile has a guidance system. You point it and shoot. The missile's got a control device inside.
Exactly. A rocket, you can still guide, but it's not as accurate. You can't hit somebody on the toilet with a rocket, I mean, unless you're really, really lucky. But, you know, because like we love to show those things from the Gulf War and stuff where, you know, the missile goes into somebody's window. That's a missile because it's guided, because you're pointing it with a laser or a camera, you are pointing it directly at a point. Whereas a rocket, you have a general idea because it has some kind of system in it that, whether gyroscopes or something that tells you whether it's going up or
down. How far can the Grad rockets go?
The Grad rockets can go about, I'm trying to think, about 45 kilometers.
So they probably can't reach Tel Aviv with a Grad.
No, but the new Fajr 3 and 4 can hit Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And now, according to Debka, Iranian armed ships are shipping to Gaza Fajr 5, which, let me see if I can get the schematics on that. That is a much larger rocket with a much larger range. Oh, here it is. It's a 200 kilo warhead. And so this is much larger than the other rockets in the Palestinian arsenal. It extends their range 85 kilometers to Tel Aviv from Gaza.
Okay, so this is hot off the press. This was just reported by Debka
today,
the Israeli intelligence newsletter that we often cite in our military reports.
So now, just again to give an idea, 2 kilogram warhead is a large
200. Yeah,
200. Yeah, what did I say?
Yeah, two.
Two.
Yeah,
so, yeah, whoops. So my that's bad. I have a cold. Okay.
Okay, that's about
operating at half
for
speed.
For those of us in America, that's about 500 pounds.
Exactly, yeah. A 500-pound warhead is heavy. So this is a large rocket. It's got a lot of explosive, and 85 kilometers gives it a heck of a range. Now, I'm sure a lot of people. Excuse me again. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering how exactly the Iranians propose to deliver these rockets. Well, I mean, there is suspicion that they might land in Egypt, they might land in Sudan, because the Sinai is largely not controlled. The Red Sea connects, you know, around the Gulf of Aden to the Persian Gulf, so the Iranian ships just sail around Saudi Arabia, drop their weapons off in either Port Sudan, which we know they've delivered weapons there before, and then have it shipped up by truck up into Gaza, or they land directly in Sinai. Again, the Egyptian government's not allowed to have an army in Sinai. So even if Egypt decided we want to be absolutely neutral, well, Camp David's basically, in essence, the Camp David Accord, which ended the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, told the Egyptians you cannot have an army in Sinai. So the Israelis are in a catch-22. If they try to get the Egyptians to play ball with them, it would imply having a very large, very heavily armed Egyptian army in Sinai. If they don't, then the Iranians can land weapons there with impunity, and the Egyptians can't stop them. So it's a catch-22. But that's most likely the route that the Iranians will take for delivering these missiles. And in terms of the U.S. fleet stopping them, we can't guarantee that it's a complicated in terms of international law, because how do we guarantee that's where the missiles were bound for? Does it say it on the ship's manifest? You know, maybe the ships say, well, we're delivering it to Sudan, and we're not at war with Sudan. You know, things like that. So it's very complicated when it comes to the U.S. stopping these ships. And if we do try to stop the Iranian ships and we do shoot at them to try to get them to stop, but they refuse to stop, then we risk sparking a war off with Iran, which is what the Iranians want at this stage. They know militarily we are very unprepared for a war. They know our population is very war weary. Mm-hmm. So they know that if they spark a major conflagration right now when the economy is in a bad way, and when we are at the height of our military arrogance, because we think a few
F-22s.
Advantage
might be to them, yeah.
Exactly. We think a few F-22s will knock Marshawn, up the Iranian
guys,
Air Force.
Why don't we open the lines to our listeners and let them join the conversation? You can call in at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we've been speaking about the escalating violence in Israel, the attacks that are coming from Gaza, the prospect of Hezbollah entering the fray from Lebanon in the north. The news that came out this morning from the Israeli news service that the Iranians are shipping a new load of Fajr, very powerful rockets to Gaza. They're not there yet, but they're on the way. What do you think about this unfolding crisis? What do you think about the prospects that the U.S. may be involved militarily? Do you have any ideas on how this situation can be diffused? Because I think we all would agree that we do not want to see a major war in the region. We certainly don't want to see, also don't want to see a confrontation between the United States and Iran and possibly Russia. So let us know what you think about the situation. It's 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Or drop us an email with your question or comment to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org.
Yeah, I think the way I see the situation, I don't fall on anybody's side. You know, I don't favor anybody in this conflict. It's been going on for such a long time. And I think the militants in Gaza, they must realize that they're using the innocent Palestinians as human shields, essentially, right? Just like the Al-Qaeda militants in Syria and Libya are using the civilians there as human shields as they rebel and they try to take down the government for, you know, whatever reasons they deem are worthwhile. But
there's no place for them to go.
Well, there's no place for them to go.
I mean, the place is blockaded by the Israelis.
They're in a blockade. They live in a ghetto.
It's like a concentration camp, really.
It is. It is. The people have restricted access to water and food, education, medicine, electricity. Their ports have a complete blockade. Even humanitarian aid that tries to get in periodically on these, you know, flotillas that go there multiple times a year are always raided and boarded by Israelis, then confiscated.
And this happened recently. It happened, 2008, 2009? And the last time this went forward, 1,400 Palestinians were killed, mm-hmm. and 33 Israelis.
And so, and how far, many of those are militants too?
Most of them are probably just people happen to be there.
Right.
And so far, 85 Palestinians and have died, and 3 Israelis. And I'm sure it's going up.
Are pretty slanted.
It runs about 30-1 against the Palestinians, which leads me to my question. This is Marshawn. Mm-hmm. Last time the Palestinians got creamed in 2008, 2009, is there a different strategy? Are the Palestinians provoking this? There are two ways of looking at it. The Palestinians are provoking this with the expectation Hezbollah will soon come in from the north, Iran will come in, and they're really going to demolish Israel. Or is Israel escalating it in hopes that they can take out the Palestinians in Gaza preparatory to attack on Iran? Which of those two strategies do you think is driving
this? I think it's a combination of the two, because I think Iran... Hamas. I'll get it right eventually. Hamas is going for. They wouldn't be going for this unless they felt that they had absolute backing of another superpower, e.g., Iran and Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. So they, and Russia's thrown its weight behind Hamas as well. So the Hamas is doing this because they know that there's going to be a military intervention by Hezbollah, by Iran, and by Russia. That having been said, Israel is not about to back down, because I think Israel's now figuring this is preparatory to the attack on Iran. Knock out Hamas, and then now we can move against Iran without an enemy to our rear.
And it's well documented that Hamas is so infiltrated with Israeli intelligence officers that nothing gets done in Hamas and in Gaza without the Israeli government knowing about it.
Oh, absolutely.
So these rocket attacks, you have to assume that they are ordained, that they're allowed to partake. You know, they know that they're coming.
And they aren't, inflicting much damage in Israel.
Right.
It's more of a fear factor going on at this point. It's the threat.
Well, and part of it, I think, what gives Hamas a unique position this time is that, as opposed to in 2000 and 2008, you said?
Opposed to 2008, 2009, yeah.
Yeah.
Just during the last interregnum, after Bush Jr. was leaving office and Obama was coming, and that's when the Israelis launched their massive attack in Gaza.
As opposed to 2008, what I think is different this time is Israel's not just going to pummel them from the air and with field artillery. Israel is going to have to go in with boots on the ground. They're going to have to march an army, basically 75,000 troops, into Gaza, which does change the equation a little bit, because it puts Hamas in a position where they can actually fight back, you know. Because you can actually shoot at patrols. You can actually shoot at troops that are invading. So I think you will see an increase in Israeli casualties this time around.
Yeah, if they have to go door to door.
Going to have to.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point. The point is to draw 75,000 to 100,000 Israeli troops to the south. You can remember, Israel's a small population. Draw the majority of Israeli troops south. Then you attack from the north, draw these the other half of the Israeli army to the north. Now they're incapable of invading Lebanon,
but, you know,
and at the same time...
That makes sense militarily, yeah.
And at the same time, they're incapable of invading, or completing the invasion of Gaza, so they're being drawn in two different directions. And then it would force the Americans to intervene directly.
But that only works if the Lebanese attack from the north. If they don't, then the Gazans are committing suicide.
Not necessarily, no. Because even if Lebanon doesn't attack from the north, Iran will intervene directly. Iran and Russia have already thrown their lot in with Hamas. So they're not going to leave Hamas high and dry.
I see. What kind of support would they, if the next step is not for Hezbollah to attack from the north, what would the Iranians or the Russians do?
Well, they're shipping in arms right now, as can be seen with these arms ships that are going to Gaza.
Right.
So to try to bog down the Israelis and force Israel to attack Iran.
But Israel ultimately could pacify Gaza, right? I mean, if the people in Gaza don't get any outside help other than armaments, other than arms, the Israelis would eventually demolish the place, right?
So long as the Iranians don't start shipping in troops. I mean, again, that is another X factor, too, that Iran might commit an army. I mean, Iran has an army in Lebanon. They have an army in Syria.
Yeah.
The only reason Assad hasn't been overthrown now is because of Russian and Iranian troops.
Let's say that again. Because that's really important. Iran has troops in Lebanon and Syria?
Yes, and so does Russia. So, and these are all from Israeli and Russian and Iranian sources. So make no mistake, the Iranians would not be shy to commit an army to Gaza as well. Now, that having been said, that would force Israel to force America's hand. And I think that's what the Iranians want. So regardless of whether Hezbollah gets involved, the goal is to use this to force America to attack Iran, force us to make the first move.
Now, you mentioned Syria. Syria is an important player in here because Syria is a very important ally of Iran. And Israel wants to attack Iran. It looks like we might go in with them on it. But Syria would be wise for us to take Syria out first, which is really, I think, what this rebellion is. We've covered for over a year now on In Context, the supposed rebellion in Syria is really a NATO-U.S. sponsored overthrow of the Syrian government in order to take them off the playing field as an ally of Iran. And the latest report in Debka that I saw on the progress of that rebellion is that it's not being successful, that many more troops will be needed to overthrow the Syrian government. So right now, things don't look too good for that overall strategy.
Well, not at all, because the Russians, according to Debka, have about 50,000 troops there, and so does Iran. I mean, combined Russian-Iranian force, maybe close to 50, 60,000 troops.
So we'd have to escalate quite a bit more. Right now, folks, our involvement in Syria has been principally by having our close regional allies bring weapons and fighters from Libya, al-Qaeda fighters from Libya, into Syria to actually terrorize the population, blow up government buildings, and try to so destabilize the Assad government that it collapses, right? I mean, that's basically what's going on, without direct involvement of U.S. troops. Although we do have, according to the New York Times, intelligence agents on the Turkish-Syrian border who are directing the flow of weapons to the NATO-backed fighters in Syria.
Of course, we may very well have special forces on the ground in Syria as well. But I think one thing to bear in mind is that I think the strategy is changing. I think they've realized they can't overthrow Assad. It's not working. So that's why Israel is. That's why Israel and the United States now are trying to link more directly to Iran. I mean, I'm reading that in U.S. sources. I'm reading that in Israeli sources. You know, all the fighting in Gaza now is about Iran. They're making it about Iran. I think the realization was that we can't take out Syria or Hezbollah or even Gaza without taking out Iran.
And the original strategy was, let's take them out piecemeal and isolate Iran, and then we take care of Iran. But now that doesn't seem to be working.
No, because I think what we didn't count on was the aggressiveness of the Russians and the Iranians. I think we didn't count on the Russians shipping in, you know, thousands upon thousands of Navy Spetsnaz and SOBR units. I think we didn't count on the Iranians sending in 25,000 troops on top of the Russian 50,000. I think we didn't count on the fact that Iran would deploy special forces to Lebanon. I think we didn't count on the Russians and the Iranians being as aggressive as they were.
Right. So what's now? Is Iran Let me just give out our phone number again here. It's 203-336-9756. We're only going to be on the air for another 15 minutes. This is, you're listening to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. So if you want to join our conversation about what's going on and the escalation, the fighting in and around Israel, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. We'll be here for about another 15 minutes on In Context. My name's Ken. I'm here with Gus and our military affairs commentator, Marchand. So Iran may be ready to go to war, right?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, again, it's a lot like World War One. All of the powers are really eager to go to war. The only thing is, we want to fight it on our terms. The Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese want to fight it on their terms. The sooner we go to war, the going to war sooner is better for the Russians and the Iranians and the Chinese than it is for the United States. What we want to do,
I agree with that.
Yeah,
we want to postpone things long enough so that we can starve out the Iranians and get them so demoralized that they'll just roll over by the time that we come to their borders.
Like the 2003 Gulf War. You know, the 1991 Gulf War. The embargo drained Iraq, and by the time we went into 2003,
they
surrendered in two waves. One wave surrendered when they heard our planes coming. The next wave surrendered when they heard our tanks coming.
And we've also been using geomodification in their areas to mess with their weather to cause droughts in the north and floods in the south, so that their food crops have been ruined 2 years in a row. On top of the economic blockades, sanctions that have been making the people just absolutely crazy with the inflation that's going on there. So I think it behooves us to postpone long enough so that we can start to reorganize ourselves by withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan enough so that we can recoup some of that lost morale.
That makes sense. For, you know, who knows what's really going on in President Obama's mind.
And we have
when
to
he's
fix
trying
our
to keep Netanyahu at
here.
Bay and say, we don't want to. Exactly.
But
now they're looking at that too, right? The Iranians are looking at this Petraeus fiasco. They're looking at our so-called fiscal cliff that we're going to be cutting defense spending, right?
Yep.
So they're probably thinking the United States is weak, because I know we tend to exaggerate bad things that happen in Iran. They're probably tending to exaggerate whatever's going
on.
Well,
so is Russia. I mean, it's and the secessionist movement in Texas, the fact that hundreds of thousands of people have already signed a petition to secede.
I'm sure that's good for morale over there, too.
And I'm sure that's getting
nationwide,
big play on Iran TV.
Nationwide, over a million. Well, actually, not as much as you'd think. It's really getting much more play in Russia. Because
uh-huh.
in Iran, secessionism is kind of a sort of odd concept.
Yeah.
Because they have sort of a sense of cultural hegemony, so you wouldn't secede.
But the Russians can relate to it. Yeah.
The Russians can relate to it. But the Russians are really playing it up in their media outlets. And what I think is really interesting is that, you know, you have a million people petitioning to secede from the United States. You have the Petraeus scandal. You have our defense budget cuts. You have the fiasco with our F-22 stealth fighter bombers malfunctioning in Kuwait. Because they got sand in their gears and their engines, and they weren't functioning right because they'd never been tested in combat. So you're the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese, and you're seeing all this, and you're saying, well, why are we going to wait around for the Americans to get stronger? Let's start this ourselves. We tend to think that we're the only ones that can start the wars, that we start the wars at the time of our choosing, and historically we always have. But now the shoe's on the other foot. Now it's their chance to start the war at the time of their choosing. And that's, I think, what's going on now with Hamas.
So people really shouldn't get so bogged down with the details of, you know, this is the barbaric Palestinians shooting rockets at the Israelis, and the Israelis should be defending themselves, and, you know, they have a right to self-determination and defense. And, you know, this is only a minor portion of the story. You know, yes, it's true. You know, there is conflict there, and there's always... In violence, there's always an aggressor and a defender, and sometimes it's mutual aggression. I think that this is one of those scenarios where the people in Gaza have been so downtrodden that they're probably willing to lay down their lives in order to get this moving, because they're just sick of living
poverty. Since 2006, 2007, right, people should be aware, the Hamas government was elected. It was a democratic election. They were put in power, and because they were deemed hostile at that point, but the Israelis and launch this embargo to try to destabilize and force them out of power.
And the Palestinians haven't really been given much of an alternative, though, either, because, you know, Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Liberation Organization would go to the Israelis and say, okay, I will make all of these concessions, just please withdraw your settlements. And the Israelis would say, no, we're not withdrawing the settlements. And then they'd say, we want more from you. So Mahmoud Abbas would say, I'll give you more. Now will we get state recognition? No, you go to the UN for state recognition, we will bury you, is what the Israelis say.
Well, you know, you mentioned that, yes.
So the average Palestinian is looking at this and saying, well, clearly the carrot's not working with the Israelis. Let's go for the stick, because what do we got to lose?
You know,
if they're going to expel us from our land anyway.
In that same negotiation, I remember clearly that the Israelis came off looking like they were the ones who offered a lot.
Yes.
And they said, we were willing to give up 90% of the things that we wanted. And they still said no. But the reason why they said no was because that 10% of the things that the Israelis wanted was the control of all the fresh water in the region.
Yeah,
in the West Bank.
And you'd have
to
be a moron to give up, to gain territory and lose all the water.
This occupation of the West Bank is absolutely critical to the intractable nature of this conflict. And President Carter wrote about it in his book, Peace Not Apartheid. He talks about how in the Camp David Accords, he had an understanding. He thought he had an agreement with the Israeli government that the settlements in the West Bank, which at that time were very few, would not continue.
Yeah.
And now today, there are approximately 350,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what can the Palestinians conclude from this? That the Israeli intention is to settle it and incorporate it into a single state solution and with the greater Israel.
And what else can they think? And the Israeli settlers are fanatics themselves. The Israeli settlers don't represent the average Israeli. They're fanatics. And, you know,
they're putting themselves in harm's way. So they're kind of militaristic in a way.
Oh, they are. And, you know, I've seen graffiti that settlers have painted on Palestinian homes saying gas the Arabs. I mean, you know, which to me is like the height of hypocrisy.
Yeah,
you know, especially
really.
Speaking as the descendant of a German Jew, it kind of really it makes me feel like, well, wait, hang on. Gas the Arabs? Wasn't that what we were complaining about, you know, all the way back when that Jews were being gassed in Germany, that the world was horrified by that? Now you're advocating the same treatment. But what does this register in the eyes of the Arab world and the greater Muslim world is that these are fanatics, no different than Al-Qaeda or Hamas.
Has the time come and gone for a peaceful settlement?
I think it really has. I mean, I think at this point, the only way you would have a peaceful settlement, there are too many superpowers who are interested in a war now. The only way you could have a peaceful settlement would be as if the Israelis stood back and said to Abbas, all right, that's it. We're withdrawing, even in the midst of this war. We're going to withdraw all of our settlements from the West Bank. We're going to recognize Palestinian statehood. And then, you know, it would delegitimize Hamas because they'd say, see,
we've legitimized
a legitimate Palestinian government, and we're going to back off and we're going to live side by side.
But in fact, they approved 850 more apartments or houses in the West Bank in June of this year.
But don't forget there's also an election coming up in January where Netanyahu is going to be up for election. And there's a lot of people in Israel who are not for this war, any conflict. There was 1,000+ people protesting just yesterday in Tel Aviv about no more war. And I really think that the time for this kind of aggression is past with the world consciousness as it is. I mean, I think in Europe, you know, all the protests about the banking occupation that's been going on, you know, how the bankers just, they bail themselves out. They exist only for their self-sustainment. And in the Middle East, they can see that these wars are just about chessboard power.
Right.
And in the United States, people are just absolutely sick of war, I think, with the exception of a very small group of neocons, you know.
Well, and I think that's, you know, again, paralleling World War One, there were letters that I read in this book on it was a history of the First World War, and there were letters from Russian soldiers writing home saying, why are we going to war over Serbia? What does this do for the Russian peasants? You know, they're like I'm a peasant. What stake do I have in Serbia's independence? You know, and mind you, Serbia blatantly assassinates the Archduke of Austro-Hungary. So the average Russian felt no desire to go to war to defend, you know, this tiny little terrorist state. And then at the same time, the average Austro-Hungarian said, well, this is terrible, but do I really want to invade Serbia? But it's always the little cliques. And like I say, the average Israeli doesn't want war, but you have a handful of fanatics. And that's who Netanyahu made his coalition government with. For the next election is the ultra-nationalists of Ehud Barak, the defense minister of his party.
Yeah.
Well, I think that probably in their heart of hearts, they Israeli leaders probably think they can have it all.
Well,
they can get the greater Israel, and basically the Palestinians who remain will just be visitors.
I think
but this
so.
Is clearly their own personal wishes. This is not the wishes of the average Israeli.
No, not at all. And the same as I'm sure the average American doesn't want to send an army to defend Israel or send an army to go to war with Iran. Mm-hmm. But it's the same story throughout history. I like to say there's nothing new in history because the average German didn't want to invade Poland.
Yeah.
You know, the average Briton didn't want to go to war at the Somme, you know, but the decisions are made, you know, by a clique. And the reason it's allowed to happen, the reason the clique is allowed, because don't for a second think that you're helpless in this equation. The reason why these cliques are allowed to send nations to war is because the people largely remain apathetic and do nothing until they're at war. Because once you're at war, you've hit a point where it's almost too late to stop it. But you have to stop it before it gets to that point. You have to stop before your nation decides to go to war.
Yeah.
Because you are the majority. You still have
a
voice.
Once the war starts...
Well, because then you're in the position to be the one guy in your unit who says, I'm not going to shoot.
Exactly.
You know? Okay, you go to jail.
Or if anybody who criticizes, it's treason. And we just have 5 minutes left in this edition of In Context. So if you'd like to give us a ring, give us your thoughts on the rising of war in and around Israel, give us a ring at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. My name is Ken. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus. And behind the board is our military affairs commentator, Marshawn.
And I think one thing that is very, very crucial to remember is that government gets its mandate from the consent of the people. If the people of the United States, if the people of the United States tell President Obama and tell the administration, no, we're not going to have any more of this. We're not going. No, you know, you want to go to war with Iran? That's fine. You go to the front. We're not going to go. We still have the opportunity to say that. We still have the opportunity to have that voice, at least before this starts. The problem is these wars break out because we say nothing, because we do nothing.
All right, looks like we have a call coming in. March is going to take care of that while we kill 30 seconds.
All right, and we are on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. And the name of the show, again, is In Context. It's WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. And we just have a couple minutes left in the show. If you'd like to give us a ring, our phone number is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. Our regularly scheduled guest, Stuart Rhodes, was unable to join us, so we'll have to try to set him for another date. He was going to talk about Oath Keepers, a new nonpartisan organization of military personnel and policemen and others who have taken an oath not to obey unconstitutional government orders. So we'll have to try to do that for another day. But in the meantime, we've been having an interesting discussion about the rising violence in Israel. What do you think about it? Is it going to get even a broader war? Is there a peaceful way out? And I think we have a caller who could comment on it.
Yes, hi.
Yes, this is Joe from Bridgewater. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air with WPKN.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to call and say thank you for this. Just, you know, I told the person who answered the phone, a very riveting discussion.
Mm. Well, thank you, Joe.
Something you never get on any reporting of the depth of the news. And kind of this question, like, is just a thought I had of, do you think that a lot of the struggles that are going on, you know, with the influence of Russia is for them to kind of reclaim some of those territories that were part of the Soviet Union that broke off from them? You know, they are trying to create a more, you know, a reorganize the Soviet Union, or is it just because they don't like the United States and it's just this chess game that we play between, you know, like a new Cold War?
You know, I think it's a combination of two, and I think that's a phenomenal question. Putin has made no bones about the fact that he was very bitter over the breakup of the Soviet Union. He was very it devastated him at the time. He was a KGB officer working in East Germany or East Berlin, And, you know, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, he called on the Politburo and said, we need troops. We can't let East Germany fall. And it just fell. It devastated him. He's dedicated his whole life to resurrecting, in essence, the Soviet Union. His party, Russia First, I believe is what it's called, is made up of old KGB men, made up of old members of the Communist Party. The two largest parties in Russia right now are the Russia First and the Communist Party of Russia. So, to a great extent, that he wants to revive the Soviet Union, and in that spirit, to revive the Russian Empire. You know, and part of that rivalry with the U.S. is to push us out. You know, the same reason why the Soviet Union struggled with the United States is it's a battle of empires as much as it is ideologies. So that's why I mean, I think that's a phenomenal question.
Oh, well, thank you. And I want to say thank you, guys. You're doing a wonderful job.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Joe.
And I think we might have another caller.
Maybe. We'll have to make it quick. We're almost over, but I hope we can take
me?
A call.
Yep, we can hear you now, sir. Go ahead.
So I think that the silence of the telephones is very telling of the complete disengagement of most people from any action, believing that if they just lay down, you know, everything will be fine. Not quite. And
you think people are just burying their heads in the sand in this one?
Well, I think it's such a complicated issue, and you're not talking about something that has, you know, a pathway that you bombed us, so we're going to fight you. It's this need of the Petraeuses of the world to fight these battles. Notice that, you know, he got busted for sex, but he ordered a lot of drone strikes. There's a lot of blood on his hands, but that isn't part of the dialogue. And at the end of the day, as I've called and said before, while we squabble and waste all of the resources, Sandy should be the message that, guys, I don't care where you're from, I don't care what you do, Mother Nature will take all of us out fast if we don't act, and we don't. You didn't hear climate change is part of the...
Caller, I think that's a really good note to leave the show on.
Because
we do have a lot of problems in common, and fighting for oil is probably not our top priority. Thank you so much for calling. Please call again, caller. We have to go now, and we're winding up this edition of In Context. We're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when our general manager, Steve, makes his report to the listeners. We will be on again then next noon. That's the 26th of November, and that will be our monthly war report, and we'll continue the conversation that we're having today, and I suspect over the next 7 days there are going to be some pretty important developments.
Yeah, sounds good. Keep your eyes to the news.
And our website is incontextreport.com.
Find
us on YouTube and Facebook.
All right.
Thank you for listening.
We'll go out with Lyndon Johnson Told the Nation.
See you next time.
See you, everybody.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it might seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to believe.